It is always a bad idea to follow a regular routine. Particularly if you are a homicidal pedophile who has come to the attention of Dexter the Avenger. Happily for me, no one had ever given McGregor this vital bit of information, and so it was quite easy for me to find him leaving his office at 6:30 p.m. as he did every day. He came out the back door, locked it, and climbed into his big Ford SUV, a perfect vehicle for hauling people around to look at houses, or for carrying bundled up little boys down to the dock. He pulled out into the traffic, and I followed him home to his modest concrete block house on Southwest 80th Street. And there was quite a bit of traffic going by the house, and I turned into a small side street half a block away and parked unobtrusively where I had a good view. There was a tall, thick hedge running down the far side of McGregor's lot that would keep the neighbors from seeing anything that went on in his yard. I sat in my car and pretended to look at a map for about 10 minutes, just long enough to scheme and be sure that he wasn't going anywhere. When he came out of his house and began to putter around the yard, shirtless and wearing a pair of battered Madras shorts, I knew how I would do it. I headed for home to get ready. In spite of the fact that I normally have a robust and healthy appetite, I always find it difficult to eat before one of my little adventures. My interior associate quivers with rising anticipation. The moon burbles louder and louder in my veins as the night slides over the city, and thoughts of food begin to seem so very ordinary. And so instead of enjoying a leisurely high-protein dinner, I paced my apartment, eager to begin, but still cool enough to wait, letting daytime Dexter melt quietly into the background, and feeling the intoxicating surge of power as the dark passenger slowly took the wheel and checked the controls. It was always an exhilarating sensation to allow myself to be pulled into the back seat and let the passenger drive. Shadows seem to grow sharper edges, and the darkness fades into a lively gray that brings everything into much sharper focus. Small sounds become loud and distinct. My skin tingles, my breath roars in and out, and even the air comes alive with smells that were certainly not noticeable during the boring and normal day. I was never more alive than when the dark passenger was driving. I forced myself to sit in my easy chair, and I held myself in, feeling the need roll over me and leave behind a high tide of readiness. Each breath felt like a blast of cold air sweeping through me and pumping me up bigger and brighter until I was like an enormous, invincible beacon of steel, ready to slash through the now dark city. And then my chair became a stupid little thing, a hiding place for mice, and only the night was big enough. And it was time. Out we went, into the bright night, the moonlight hammering at me and the dead roses breath of the Miami night blowing across my skin. And in almost no time at all, I was there, in the shadows cast by McGregor's hedge, watching and waiting and listening, just for now, to the caution that curled around my wrist and whispered, "Patience." It seemed pathetic that he could not see something that gleamed as brightly as I did, and the thought gave me another surge of strength. And I pulled on my white silk mask, and I was ready to begin. Slowly, invisibly, I moved from the darkness of the hedge and placed a child's plastic piano keyboard beneath his window, putting it under a gladiolus bush so it would not be seen immediately. It was bright-eyed and blue, less than a foot long, and only had 8 keys, but it would repeat the same 4 melodies endlessly until the battery died. I switched it on and stepped back into my place in the hedge. Jingle Bells played. And then Old MacDonald. for some reason. A key phrase was missing in each song, but the little toy piped on and into London Bridge in the same cheerfully lunatic tone. Was enough to make anyone crazy, but it probably had an extra effect on someone like MacGregor, who lived for children. At any rate, I certainly hope so. I had quite deliberately chosen the little keyboard to lure him out, and I sincerely hoped, in fact, that he would think that he had been found out, and that a toy had come from hell to punish him. After all, why shouldn't I enjoy what I do? It seemed to work. We were only on the third repetition of London Bridge when he came stumbling out of his house with a look of wide-eyed panic. He stood there for a moment, gaping around, his receding reddish hair looking like it had gone through a storm, and his pale belly hanging slightly over the waist of his dingy pajama buttons. He did not look terribly dangerous to me, but of course, I was not a 5-year-old boy. After a moment in which he stood with his mouth open and scratched himself and looked like he was modeling for a statue of the Greek god of stupidity, MacGregor located the source of the sound. Jingle bells, again by now. He stepped over and bent slightly to touch the little plastic keyboard, and did not even have time to be surprised before I had a noose of 50-pound test fishing line pulled tight around his throat. He straightened and thought he might struggle for a moment. I pulled tighter, and he changed his mind. "Stop fighting," we said in our cold and commanding passenger voice. "You'll live longer." And he heard his future in the words and thought he might change it. So I pulled hard on his leash and held it like that until his face turned dark and he dropped to his knees. Just before he passed out completely, I eased the pressure. "Now do as you're told," we said. He didn't say anything. He just choked in a few large and painful breaths, so I tweaked the line a touch. "Understand?" we said, and he nodded, so I let him breathe. He did not try to fight anymore, as I frog-marched him into the house for his car keys and then back out into his big SUV. I climbed into the seat behind him, holding the leash in a very tight grip and allowing him only enough breath to stay alive for now. "Start the car," we told him, and he paused. "What do you want?" he said, in a voice that was rough with new-made gravel. "Everything," we said. "Start the car." "I have money," he said. I pulled hard on his cord. "Buy me a little boy," we said. I held it tight for a few seconds. Too tight for him to breathe, but just long enough to let him know that we were in charge. We knew what had to be done, and we would let him breathe only at our pleasure from now on. And when I loosened the line again, he had nothing to say. He drove as we told him to, back up to Southwest 80th Street to Old Cutler Road and then south. There was almost no traffic this far out, not at this time at night. We turned into a new development that had been going up on the far side of Snapper Creek. Construction had halted due to the owner's conviction for money laundering, and we would not be disturbed. We guided MacGregor through a half-built guard booth, around a small traffic circle, east toward the water, and to a halt beside a small trailer, the temporary office of the site, now left to teen thrill seekers and others like me who only wanted a little privacy. We sat for a moment, enjoying the view, moon over the water, with pedophile in noose in the foreground. Very beautiful. I got out and pulled MacGregor out after me. Pulled him hard so that he fell to his knees and clawed at the line around his neck. For a moment, I watched him choking and drooling in the dirt, his face turning dark again and his eyes going red. And then I pulled him to his feet and pushed him up the 3 wooden steps and into the trailer. And by the time he had recovered enough to know what was going on, I had him tied to the top of a desk, hands and feet secured with duct tape. MacGregor tried to speak and just coughed instead. I waited. Now there was plenty of time. "Please," he said, finally, in a voice like sand on glass. "I'll give you whatever you want." "Yes, you will," we said, and saw the sound of it cut into him. And even though he couldn't see it through my white silk mask, we smiled. I took out the photos I had taken from his boat and showed them to him. He stopped moving completely, and his mouth hung open. "Where did you get those?" he said, sounding rather petulant for someone who was about to be cut into small pieces. "Tell me who took these pictures."
"Why should I?"
he said. I used a pair of tin snips and cut off the first 2 fingers of his left hand. He thrashed and screamed, and the blood came, which always made me angry. So I shoved a tennis ball into his mouth and cut off the first 2 fingers of his right hand. "No reason," I said, and I waited for him to slow down just a little bit. When he finally did, he rolled an eye to me, and his face was filled with that understanding that comes when you have gone beyond pain into knowing that the rest of this was forever. I took the tennis ball out of his mouth. "Who took the pictures?" He smiled. "I hope one of them was yours," he said, which made the next 90 minutes a lot more rewarding.